As we begin, I want to ask you, who is God to you? Who is God to you? Not in a theoretical, theological sense, but in the practical day-to-day of your life. Who is God to you? Some might see him as a life coach or a personal trainer, maybe a judge or a CEO. And it's incredibly important to think about this, because who God is to you will define your life in a way that few other questions will. If he's a life coach or a personal trainer, it is a bit inconvenient seeing him. You meet up with him reluctantly a few times a week, and you always hope it's a little bit shorter and they don't keep the time and all that sort of stuff. They're going to challenge you in uncomfortable ways, but you don't really want to be there. If he's a judge, I'm desperately justifying everything that I do, why I'm not as bad as I could be, why I'm not as bad as other people, all the good things that I've done, racking up credit, hoping he doesn't see, burying myself in hypocrisy. If he's a CEO, he's distant and remote. He's in control in a kind of abstract sense. He's kind of distant from me. I don't really have much to do with him. He's interested in kind of the macro things, but he's not interested in my day-to-day. I'm not going to bother him with that sort of stuff. The beautiful truth I want us to see from the passage this morning is that if you're a Christian, God is not distant or severe or remote or disinterested. He is your merciful Father. He is extravagantly merciful. And what I want us to take away this morning is that knowing our Father's extravagant mercy creates lives of humble generosity. I'll say that again. Knowing our Father's extravagant mercy creates lives of humble generosity. I'm joining you midway through this series, and we're looking at the next chunk of Luke's account of the life of Jesus. It is a big chunk. We're looking at the whole of Luke 6. That was just an extract that we were reading earlier. But in Luke 6, we encounter lives which have two different views of God, of the character of God, of who he is to them. One of those views leads to rigorous rule-keeping, hung up on the technicalities, trying to force others into a similarly miserable existence of constantly failing to measure up. The other frees up sons and daughters to live with generosity. We're going to spend some time walking through the passage. We've got a lot of ground to cover, so I'm going to move quickly. But we're going to be covering it with three main points, two controversies and one invite to the blessed life. We're then going to look at three parables that Jesus gives us to apply this. So let's dig in. Look down at your Bibles, chapter 6, verses 1 to 5. Controversy 1. The Pharisees don't know the Lord of the Sabbath. Controversy 1. The first controversy comes as we meet Jesus and the disciples on the Sabbath. They're walking through the grain fields, and they naturally, they're hungry. They start to pick the grain and eat it. But what you may not have realized is that they were doing something incredibly controversial at the time. They're immediately jumped on by the Pharisees, the religious leaders of the day, who come across as a little bit like panto villains throughout Luke. They're always in the background, ready to pounce. And here their complaint is, verse 2, why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath? Where are they coming from here? Well, in the Old Testament, when God gave his law to the Israelites, to his people at Mount Sinai, he told them to keep the Sabbath day holy. Now, the Ten Commandments and the law around it was massively important to the Israelites. And so, naturally, over time, they thought of more ways that they could protect these and obey these. And they ended up creating these kind of fences around the laws as a way of preventing you from getting anywhere near breaking the law. And so that's what they're having to go at here. Apparently, according to those sub-laws, the disciples were technically reaping, threshing, winnowing, and preparing food, all four of which were prohibited on the Sabbath. So, yeah, you can see why they were in trouble. How's Jesus going to respond? How's he deal with that? Well, he has two answers. First, that their understanding of the purpose of the Sabbath is wrong. And second, that they've misunderstood who Jesus is. Now, the first answer he gives is kind of addressed in the second controversy that we're going to look at, so I'm going to cover that there. But the main one that he speaks about here is that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. They've misunderstood who he is. The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. It's a bit of an odd claim, isn't it? But that's how Jesus referred to himself often, the Son of Man, as the God-man of Daniel 7. It is a big, bold claim. He is the representative of God's people to God, given authority by God. It is a big claim. Jesus says he is Lord of the Sabbath. He has authority over the administration of God's holy day. He is the right to interpret the law. Now, an illustration might help here. Any cricket players in the room? Any former cricket players in the room? Anyone who's watched cricket? I might need to just work out how much padding I need to give to this. Okay, so for those of you unfamiliar with cricket, you probably walked past cricket pitches sometime, and it looks really confusing. There's lots of people doing completely inscrutable things on the pitch, really not very obvious. But one of the things that you'll see is in the middle of the pitch, you've got a big grassy field. In the middle of it, you've got a wicket. And this is looks like different grass. It's got stumps and stuff like that. The club I was at used to have kind of a rope around it during the week. And it used to say, keep off the grass. Keep off the grass. You weren't allowed on it. Now imagine that you turn up on cricket on Saturday as a cricket fan, which all of you clearly are. And you see, to your shock and horror, a load of men wandering towards the wicket in contravention of the sign. Keep off the wicket. They're wandering towards it. They've got a ball in their hand, a bat in their hand. They clearly look like they're going to play cricket. Shocking behaviour. And you tell them and go, no, keep off the wicket. Keep off the grass. Look at the sign. You see someone pulling out the sign and taking the rope to the side. The club chairman is walking over and dragging the stakes off and putting it to the side and putting the scoreboard up. And you shout, no, keep off. You haven't understood what the sign is for. It's to protect the sanctity of the pitch for that purpose, for the activity they're about to do. And you also haven't understood who is interpreting the law. The club chairman is the one who decides how it's administered. The club chairman decides how that pitch is used. And what's going on here, in the same way, is the Pharisees are saying to the Lord of the Sabbath, no, you don't do that on the Sabbath. And we can see how ridiculous that is. It is Jesus' prerogative to interpret this. It is Jesus who understood it and came up with that law. He is allowed to say how it's lived out. He makes the rules. The second controversy, the Pharisees don't know the life-giving God of the Sabbath, verses 6 to 11. It says, on another Sabbath, Luke swings the camera angle round. Jesus has gone to synagogue and he sees a man with a withered hand there. Predictably, our panto villains are there in the background. The scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath so that they might find a reason to accuse him. What's Jesus going to do? But he knew their thoughts. And he said to the man with the withered hand, come and stand here. And he rose and stood there. And Jesus said to them, I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it? And after looking around at them all, he said to them, stretch out your hand. And he did so, and his hand was restored. Jesus isn't going to play games with the Pharisees here. They've turned law-keeping into a tick-box exercise that wears down and actually harms those who follow them. The Sabbath here is meant to serve people, not for people to serve the Sabbath. It is meant to be life-giving. It's far short of what God has set it up for. But more than that, their hearts are so twisted that the Sabbath day regulations are actually used here to try and trap the very Lord of the Sabbath who instituted them. The Son of the God who gave them that day. Do you see that they are not trying to please God of this? Rather than it being this day which is for communion with God and knowing him and pleasing him and enjoying time with him, it's become a tool for them to trap his Son. It says this, they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. In contrast to this, true disciples know the blessed life of our generous Father. Now, this is the longer chunk of Luke, and so we're going to spend most of our time. We're going to look at the Sermon on the Plain, which is Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount. Look down at verse 17. We see it is a kingdom that repurposes misfits and outcasts. Contrast this with the Pharisees and what they were doing, how they were treating those who were on the outskirts, how they were treating the vulnerable. We see Jesus gathers people, all kinds of people from all over Israel. He chooses fishermen, and tax collectors and radicals. And when we see his kingdom in action, it's not the Pharisees' legalism which characterizes it. It's generous mercy. He came down with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem, the seacoast of Tyre and Sidon. That is all over the place. Not the obvious place to recruit disciples for ministry. All those who came to hear him and be healed of their diseases, and those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured, and all the crowd sought to touch him, for power came out from him and healed them all. Look at how the Pharisees showed what God is interested in the first chunk, the first chunks that we looked at. They've caricatured him as this, as an auditor rather than a father. One who is interested in the tick box exercise of the law, but does not care about the person. Look at what Jesus cares about here. Look at what God's heart is actually for, what pleases him. Mercy oozes out of Jesus' ministry. People come to him and they are healed, they are cleaned, they are restored, they are repurposed, they are sent on their way with purpose. But Jesus' kingdom is also one of counterintuitive blessing. Now, our culture has a very specific idea of what blessed life looks like, or what a blessed life looks like. These are some alternative beatitudes that I've come up with this morning. You can tell me how I've done on these. Blessed are you who cut out people who are a drain on you, for yours is good mental health. Blessed are you who find your purpose, for yours is meaning and fulfillment. Blessed are you who love yourself, but if you don't love yourself, who else will? Blessed are the independent, for yours is security. Blessed are you who hold on to your rights, for you owe nothing to anyone. Look at how Jesus characterizes his kingdom. Look down at verse 20. It's you who are poor, you who are hungry, you who are weak, who are hated and reviled and spurned. This is no one's definition of a blessed life. If you Google non-blessed life, it'll probably come up with something a little bit like this, because it looks like hardship and suffering. So why are these people blessed? Fundamentally, verse 22, their situation comes on account of the Son of Man, it says. On Jesus' account. These are disciples who are blessed. This is not just a general blessing on poor people or sad people or hated people. It's people who have given up everything to be a disciple of Jesus. These Christians are poor because they've invested in the kingdom rather than in those beatitudes I made up at the start. They've not progressed to a higher paid role because they've prioritized serving a church over salary. They're disciples who've given away money to those who need it. They're disciples who've lost their jobs because they've stood up for Jesus. They're Christians who weep now because their lives are hard. And we need to be honest about this, because true discipleship is costly. If you want to live as a disciple of Jesus, it will cost you in money, in time, in social standing. But Jesus says that this is where blessing is found, because there are better riches out there than any one of the Beatitudes I made up. Look at verse 23. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. For so their fathers did to the prophets. This has always been the pattern for faithful discipleship and obedience to God. This has always been where real blessing is found. Not because it's easy now, but because the promises so far outweigh the sacrifices. Rejoice. Leap for joy. It's generously rewarded. On the flip side of this, Jesus says, woe to the rich and the full and the laughing and those spoken well of. Why? Because this is the reward that the false prophets had. It's brief. It's short-term approval, but ultimately no reward. It lasts no longer than the initial nod at someone seeing your behaviour the first time around. You've received your consolation. You shall be hungry. You shall mourn and weep. Jesus said that these people are to be pitied. They should be sad because of how fleeting their wealth is. And I think for those of us who were Christians, or have been Christians for a little while, we instinctively go, yeah, sure, yeah. But how much is that reflected in our lives? How easily is that seen that we think that kingdom currency is worth more? Because it's so easy to run after the other stuff, isn't it? a while back, the sweets brand Haribo ran an advertising campaign. Sorry, a lot of my illustrations will be around marketing just because Bustman's holiday sort of thing. Some of you may have seen it. It featured a child in a classroom being given a sweet. And the child is told, if you can hold on to this sweet and not eat it, when I come back, I'll give you more. The adult leaves the room and it shows the child and shows their face looking kind of... No, it's not sure I can hold this. And then they go for it. They eat it straight away, every time. I actually tried this experiment a little while ago at youth group, and they genuinely ate it before I'd finished giving the instruction. The point is that Haribo is so good that you couldn't possibly hold on to it and wait. But so often, we are like those children with all the fleeting rubbish that the world offers us. We're told that the blessed life is poverty now and riches later, is hunger now and satisfaction later, is suffering now and glory later. And instead we go grab, take, now. Because we just struggle to believe that it's going to be so much better. But Jesus tells us that this blessed life is so much better because it comes to us from a Father who knows what we need and loves to give it to us. This counterintuitive blessed life and the kingdom reward we're waiting for is transformative. It changes us. How does it look? Verses 27 to 38. It looks like over the top generosity to those who hate you and mistreat you. The disciples are told they are to be radically merciful. When we are hated, we are to deliberately and consciously do good to those people. When people curse us, abuse us, we're to pray for them and wish good on them. When we're insulted and disrespected and treated poorly, we're to deliberately leave ourselves open for more. We're not to claim our rights, but to go over and above for people who don't deserve it and have wronged us. Striking, isn't it? There's not many things that Jesus tells us to do which are less comfortable than this. And I know we can apply caveats and wisdom and reference other bits in the Bible which kind of add nuance to this. But for now, I want us to be uncomfortable with what Jesus says because that's what he's trying to do. If we're running after excuses and reasons why it's not quite, why we don't have to quite obey like that, it's probable that we need to be challenged by this. Our default is meant to be radical generosity and mercy to those who do not deserve it. I'll be honest, I've been finding this really hard at the moment. I've had a difficult few weeks at work where I had some challenges with some leadership. And I feel a little bit like I've been manipulated and there have been some broken promises and some lost trust. And it is hard for me to look at this passage and say, what does Jesus say I am to do in response to this? Radical mercy and generosity. I need to wish good on my bosses and to pray for them. I need to work harder than I need to. I need to open myself up to further insult and possible abuse. I'm to deny my rights and be merciful instead. Why? Why such an unusual and even ridiculous response? Because that's the sort of Father I have. This is how I've treated God. This is how he has treated me. Love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. My father is not a disciplinarian, kind of Victorian parent who is checking to see whether I'm obeying from a distance. He's the generous and merciful God who is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Who's looked at my life when I've wandered. Who's looked at my sin and my disobedience and my selfishness and my pride and my arrogance and all my sin and the ugliness in me. And he's gone, I will love him and be merciful to him. And if you're a Christian, that's what he's done for you. He has looked at you in your sin and your shame and your filth, and he has gone, I'm going to send my beloved son to die for them. Not once they've cleaned themselves up, not once they've got their life straight. When they were at their lowest, Jesus has come and he has washed you clean and he has died in your place so that you can know God. He has been kind to the evil and the ungrateful. And it includes those who haven't turned to him yet. the people we see day to day and we invite to come to church and stuff like that. The reason we do that is because he's been kind to us in the past. He's been unkind to ungrateful and evil people. Surely he will do that again. And even if they won't turn to him, day after day, he gives good gifts to them. Day after day, he holds off his judgment. This is the kind of God we have, who willingly opens himself up to another day of being slighted, another day of being abused and thwarted and rejected. Whose son went to the cross silent, beaten, scorned, spat on, mistrialed, willingly opened himself up to abuse for the sake of evil and ungrateful people. This is the merciful God we worship, and the merciful God who has adopted us as sons. I use the word sons there because those are the ones who inherit here, not because of a gender thing. We are sons and daughters. We are heirs of God Almighty. As Tony mentioned earlier, some of you know my dad. He was a policeman for the majority of his career, about 30 years of it. And during that time, every now and again, he would bring his kit back from work and it was dead exciting. You'd be sat in the kitchen having dinner and you'd just see, like, he'd bring this big heavy bag and you'd go, there's some cool stuff in there. And after dinner, like, out the room, we'd go through it, inevitably. And we'd try some of the stuff on and we'd wander around the house dressed as policemen. It was great. Sometimes there's an asp in there. Some of you know what an asp is. It's like a baton which kind of extends. It's a little bit like you kind of whip it and a metal sword comes out. It's really cool. And as a child, that was awesome. But you're wandering around dressed as your dad because sons copy their fathers. That's the point Jesus is making here. It's a little bit less common now because we don't really have sort of family trades in quite the same way they did then. But the point here is that you will be sons of your father when you do what he does. Sons copy their fathers. And the mark that we are sons is that we act like him. This is why the Pharisees are so far off the mark. It's because the way they live and their application of the law looks nothing like the character of God. That's what's so wrong about it. It's slander. When the Pharisees say, do this, God is like this, they are lying about the character of God, and they are pushing people away from him because they think he is a capricious, law-creating God who cares nothing about the people. But he is generous and kind to ungrateful and evil people. He's not like that. He's the providing God who gives food for his people and satisfies them. He's the healing God who gives Sabbath rest to his people and restores them. So we are meant to copy him. We are meant to be counterintuitively merciful because we have received so much mercy. But more than that, our mercy and generosity is meant to be shaped by our anticipation and expectation of future mercy from him. Do you see that in the passage? God does not just proclaim us children and leave us to it. He's our Father who promises to continue being merciful and to continue being generous to us and with our reward to come. Look at verse 38. This is what's promised in the future to us. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. My brother and I moved into our new place earlier this year, and there have been plenty of surprises along the way, but one of them is just the sheer amount of recycling created. Has anyone seen that? It's just bizarre. I don't even know where it comes from. But we've got this sort of box in our kitchen, which we fill up, and you just kind of look and go, I don't even understand where that's come from. You go and put it into the bin, and you see that the bin, this massive wheelie bin, is almost full. So the recycling drops into the gaps, and you press down on it, and you put your full body weight on it to kind of squish more in. And you pour more on and shut the lid on and hope that it kind of stays in there. This is the kind of image of what God is doing with his mercy. Look down the passage again. Good measure. Pressed down. Shaking together. Running over. Will be put into your lap. Jesus is milking this because God does not just kind of give us a little bit of mercy and just leave us to it. His disposition towards you is I'm going to keep pouring mercy on. I'm going to press it down and shake it around so more fits in. I'm going to push the lid down so it holds a bit more in. God is not stingy to us. He is abundantly, extravagantly merciful. And so our disposition towards others is meant to come out of that because we have been so generously treated. God is no one's debtor. We're never shortchanged by him. The reward is more than worth the sacrifice. And so with those promises in mind of true blessedness, shaped by our Father's character, driven by the generous mercy he promises, Jesus then gives us three parables to warn of the danger of faking him. I wonder if you notice this as we go through the Gospels. Actually, we're often quite apologetic about our faith. We're often quite careful to try and avoid putting people off by challenging them too much. Jesus actively deters people from following him unless they will take it seriously, unless they will turn. He gives three parables here to warn about the danger of self-deception. Parable one, blind guides. Look down at verse 39. Can a blind man lead a blind man? Will they not both fall into a pit? A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. This is a pretty simple image, and it's not hard for us to understand. If you're being led by someone, they need to be able to see where they're going. And at the same time, you can't outstrip someone who you are copying. If you are just replicating what they're doing, you will just do what they do. And if they are blind, if they have things in their eyes which prevent them from seeing where they are going, if they have a log in their eye, as Jesus says here, they will not lead you where you need to go. If you have a log in your eye, you will not be able to lead people where they need to go. And so the challenge here to us is, do we see clearly? Do we actually see this Jesus that the Bible tells us about? Do we actually see the Father that he is pointing us towards? If we are teaching others, if we are pointing to him to our neighbours, and actually we don't know Jesus, we're blind guides. We have logs in our eyes. Second, fruit trees. Verse 43, for no good tree bears bad fruit, nor again does a bad tree bear good fruit. For each tree is known by its own fruit. For figs are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor are grapes picked from a bramble bush. The good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil. For out of the abundance of the heart, his mouth speaks. Again, a pretty simple picture. We may not be the most green finger people in the world, but I mean, I've got a courtyard and a whole garden. Couldn't grow a thing in it. Absolutely hopeless. But even I know that if you go to a pear tree, you do not see peaches on it. If you see a rotten tree, you should not expect to see fruit on it. Jesus says the type and quality of a tree determines what it produces, and it's the same with people. Interestingly here, our speech is held out as the kind of barometer of our hearts. Our speech reveals our hearts. You can tell a lot by a person's speech. If I'm constantly talking about my work, it's what I care about. If I'm constantly talking about my worries, it's because I'm an anxious person, I'm concerned. If I'm constantly bitter or angry or crude, it's likely that actually that comes out of a heart that is bitter and angry and crude. And so Jesus says we can deceive ourselves as much as we like, but ultimately what's on the inside comes out. And that's what matters. Let's ask ourselves, what sort of fruit is coming out of my heart? And thirdly, foundations. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I tell you? Everyone who comes to me and hears my words and does them, I will show you what he's like. He's like a man building a house who dug deep and laid the foundations on the rock. And when a flood arose, the stream broke against that house and could not shake it because it had been well built. But the one who hears and does not do them is like a man who built a house on the ground without foundation. When the stream broke against it, immediately it fell, and the ruin of that house was great. Again, not a difficult image to understand. If a house doesn't have good foundations, it will be incredibly vulnerable to the elements. Earlier this week, we had a team day at work, and as one of the team building experts, this is one of the downsides of marketing. You get roped into a lot of awkward team building stuff. One of the exercises was we were each given packs of spaghetti and marshmallows. And as a team, we were to build the tallest structure we could with those tools. And what you learn pretty quickly is that marshmallows aren't very effective as a bonding agent or actually for structural integrity of a building. Same for spaghetti. And it's quite hard to build any height on it, as you'd imagine. But also you see that gee, the foundations are massively important, even on something like that. You just rest it on a table and what happens is it just slips. Any pressure is applied to it anywhere and it just drops. The foundations determine the solidity of the building. And you can look at a building and without looking at the foundations, it's quite hard to tell, is it real or not? Is it going to stand or not? But the foundations don't lie. Jesus says here that there are those who say, Lord, Lord, who look like disciples, but do not obey him. This is a scary place to be, and I think a lot of us will know people who have done this in the past, who have said, Lord, Lord, but aren't here anymore. When life got hard, or when it got easy, gave up on following Jesus, and went back to the world. Jesus says here, we might hear what he's saying, but unless we do it, unless we actually live like our Father, unless we exercise that radical mercy and have our lives transformed by it, we are like houses without foundation, just waiting to be knocked over. These are tough images for us to end with, but Jesus gives us these not because he's mean or because he likes to crush us, but because hypocrisy and self-deception is incredibly dangerous. We go through our lives saying, Lord, Lord, but not obeying Jesus, not living in faithful obedience to our generous Father. We will find ourselves with little to hold on to when we face Jesus. And so if hearing those you've been needled and feel convicted, can I ask you that you don't do what the Pharisees do? Filled with rage, wonder how to deal with this Jesus. Instead, will you look at God the Father's heart? Will you look at this Father who is generous and gracious and merciful to those who fundamentally do not deserve it and does so tirelessly? Will you look at that heart and go, I need to come to him? Will you ask him to have the log removed from your eye? Will you ask him for a heart that bears good fruit? Will you ask him to help digging those foundations of obedience? His Father is the yardstick for mercy. Come to him. Come to him. I'm going to pray. And then we're going to sing our last song before we close. Father God, thank you that when we pray to you, we can do so not wondering whether you care or whether you are listening, but confident that you are listening and you do care because you are extravagantly merciful. You look at sinful people and you reach out to them in love. And so if you did that for us when we were strangers and enemies, how much more will you do this for us now that we are sons and daughters? Father, I ask that you would help us to be faithful, that we would dig those foundations, that we would obey Christ, that we would listen to what he's saying, and we would do it. And I ask that for each of us in this room, that we would go out this week as people who are captivated by your generous mercy and can't help but show it to people around us. I ask that for your glory's sake. Amen.